Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell Reed, my co-host Gwen Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Malcolm Telford, author of Flying Sand Dollars, Left-Handed Crabs, Giant Earwigs, and Other Curiosities. So, was it just luck that you found out what you really wanted to study, Malcolm? What inspired your fascination with zoology and kept you pursuing it all your life?
Well, I think I've been a biologist all of my life. As a child, I spent days and hours pond guddling, looking at beetles and stuff like that. I just sort of gravitated to it naturally. And after I came to Canada and started getting my education sorted out seriously, that was when I specialised in zoology.
Uh-huh.
And as the saying goes, I don't think I ever looked back afterwards.
You said that you got hooked on the idea of research in the Arctic while you were a student and were accepted as a field assistant for the summer. Can you tell us something about that expedition? What was the expedition researching, and why was the project so interesting to you?
Well, the project was interesting to me for a number of reasons. First of all, because it was based in the Arctic. As a student at McGill, I had come in contact with the Arctic biologist. McGill was a centre for research in the Arctic, and a number of graduate students worked up there regularly, so I met people who were dealing with hermaphroditism and sticklebacks and the sex life of polar bears and the diet of walruses and all sorts of things like that. So I was naturally interested in the Arctic. And
yeah.
The other thing was that I had for years been a keen fisherman, and when I found out that the Fisheries Research Board was going to be doing a survey of the resources in lakes and rivers across the Northwest Territories, I banged in an application, and Lady Luck smiled on me.
So did you travel all over the Northwest Territories, or were you based in one place?
No, we went from Yellowknife. We flew out, and we were dropped down on a lake, and then every 2 weeks we were picked up and moved towards the east, and we finally came out through Rankin Inlet and down to Fort Churchill.
Sounds wonderful. I took a course up there in Yellowknife, a short course when I was studying for my principal certificate.
Now, when would that have been?
Oh, gosh, many years ago now.
Yeah.
And there were people from who taught all over the Arctic, and it was fascinating, you know, to exchange experiences of teaching in all these different places.
A sort of wild place when I went there, which was 1959. It was all dirt roads and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't get to go far from Yellowknife, but the dirt roads were still there. You published Flying Sand Dollars with Telwell, a company which assists with self-publishing. Why did you choose to self-publish? Was it a positive experience? Did you find Telwell helpful?
Well, I certainly found them helpful. They have certainly served me very well. When I first started writing, I was thinking of a much more technical sort of a book about creepy crawlies. And it was going to be extensively illustrated, because I do quite a lot of drawing and detailed painting of beetles and stuff like that. So I couldn't raise any interest anywhere in it. And so I thought, well, okay, maybe what I'm going to have to do is self-publish. But the cost of publishing with coloured illustrations and so on was just prohibitive. So I scrapped that. I've got boxes of that down in my basement. And I turned to writing these essays. I chose just topics that I liked, things that had interested me over the years. And I get one idea, and then the whole thing sort of grows around it. So, for instance, one of the essays is about Samuel Pepys' wig. And what started me on that was that I was thinking about evolutionary history of lice. body lice and head lice and so on. And as I thought about that, I thought, well, gosh, you know, apart from all the medical stuff, the diseases and so on, there's also the hygiene business. And lice had an absolutely wonderful existence for centuries because people didn't bath. And so that sort of got me interested in the history of hygiene and stuff like that. And so when I finally assembled it all, it came out as a story about Samuel Pepys and the wig and people bathing or not bathing, and then that seeped into the evolutionary history of lice. And the molecular clock allows us to put sort of time stamps on evolutionary events, and that reflects back on the early history of man. So it became quite a complex story, but it all
started. Wide-ranging, one might say.
Yes.
That's what I love about those essays. They start with one thing and you go, wow, we've turned, turned into something else.
I have elsewhere described my book as being a little bit like stream of consciousness, but not in the usual literary sense of that, but certainly one idea leading into another.
Well, it certainly makes for interesting reading. I really enjoyed them. You preserved some of the drawings in the book.
Those were all new ones that I did. Mm-hmm. Just little ink drawings that I... so that each chapter finishes with an ink drawing that has some bearing on what had been in the text, yeah. Mm.
One of the characteristics of your book is the way in which you bring together what seemed to be at first widely divergent material. So do you find that analogies and surprises are the spoonful of sugar that helps the science go down? Or is it because you really wanted the book, first and foremost, to be one about people?
Well, it certainly is about people, about people that I've known and about myself and people that I've read about. So I would certainly describe it as being a book about people. But it also stems a little bit out of my teaching style. Now, the book is not meant to be didactic. It's not a book of instruction.
No.
But when I was teaching undergraduate students, I would try to approach things obliquely for two reasons. First, you could catch their attention with an unexpected approach to a subject. And secondly, you could lure them into thinking it through and arriving at the conclusion for themselves. So I felt that that was important. Follow my wandering course to interesting points.
So how about reading to us some more from Flying Sand Dollars, Left-Handed Crabs, Giant Earwigs and Other Curiosities?
Okay, I'd like to do that. What I've picked out is a piece from an essay called Your Research is Crap. And this essay deals with the way that new ideas sometimes get received into the science of the time. And it also deals with Beatrix Potter, treated very badly by the scientific community. Beatrix Potter was my favorite author. She still ranks pretty high, but back then, when I was 6 years old, she was the greatest, better than A.A. Milne or Kenneth Graham. Her anthropomorphized animals were so real to my childish mind, and her exquisite illustrations were utterly convincing. If I had a favorite picture, it may have been the one showing Samuel Whiskers and Anna Maria, the quintessential outsiders, making good their escape. I was also intrigued by Mr. Jeremy Fisher, an offbeat hero. After his terrifying encounter with the trout, he organized a congenial dinner with his friends, Sir Isaac Newton and Alderman Ptolemy Tortoise. What appealed was the collegiality of a frog, a newt, and a tortoise comfortably fraternizing. That could have been my first vision of ecological harmony, although, of course, it was sheer fantasy. But fantasy or not, it made a deep and lasting impression on me. There are countless instances of animals and plants living in intimate relationships. One coupling was of serious scientific interest to the multi-talented Beatrix Potter as a young woman. In what I might term her pre-Peter Rabbit period, she became an expert mycologist, or specialist in fungi. Working patiently, she was the first mycologist in Britain to germinate 40 or 50 species under controlled conditions. When she tried to interest George Massey, a mushroom expert at Kew Gardens, he gave her the brush off. Beatrix Potter had two insurmountable strikes against her: no university education, and she was a woman. That made her doubly an outsider. She made one attempt to publish her research in a paper to the Linnaean Society in 1898, but she was unable to attend the meeting herself. Women were not admitted. The paper was never published in the proceedings of the Society, and the only record of it lies in the sparse notes in her journal. Vindication came exactly 100 years later, in 1998, when the Linnaean Society offered a formal apology for the shabby treatment she received. One of the things that interested Potter was the nature of lichens. Today it is well known that they are composed of algae, or in some cases cyanobacteria, and living fungi close together. It has been claimed that Beatrix Potter discovered this peculiar relationship, but that is not correct. In fact, she got it wrong, and in her journal said, "Upon the subject of chlorophyll and symbiosis, I am afraid I am unpleasant. I could hardly contain myself with amusement."
Many thanks, Malcolm. It's been such fun to have you on the show. So where can readers buy your book?
You can buy it from Amazon, Chapters, Barnes & Noble. It's available on Kindle and Kobo, and I have a few copies if people want to buy a copy from me.
Thank you. To connect with us, please send comments, queries, or suggestions for whom we might interview in future programs to our website, www.wordonthehills.com, where all our broadcasts are archived. We love to hear from you and welcome your comments on our programs. Thanks for tuning in to the show. We hope you'll join us for another program next week on Northumberland 89.7, Truly Local Radio.